This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's called the common loon, but it looks decidedly uncommon. These large water birds with distinctive black and white patterned bodies, iridescent black heads, and startling red eyes. And then there's the haunting call of the loon, long a staple of a summer night on northern New England lakes. That's a male loon yodeling, a call used to protect territory. And frankly, New Hampshire's loons could use some protection. In addition to long-standing threats from lead tackle and habitat disruption, these water birds face new dangers, including possibly malaria, which caused one loon death in Lake Umbagog last year. But it's not all bad news. Huge efforts to help loons have been underway for years now and may be paying off. Today in The Exchange, we'll find out more, and later we'll turn our attention to a smaller creature and its enormous struggle against a mysterious disease. Let's hear from you. Your questions, comments, observations about loons are welcome. Call in 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Harry Vogel, senior biologist and executive director of the Loon Preservation Committee based in Moultonboro. And Harry, it's been a while. It's nice to see you.
Good morning, Laura. Nice to see you.
Also with us, Dave Anderson, Director of Education with the Forest Society and co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. And Dave, welcome back.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, guys, before we start in with all the science and the research and the concerns and the tracking that, Harry, your group has been doing for such a long time, why are loons so awesome? Dave, why do we love them so much?
Well, that sound of a loon on a summer lake is so iconic. And so it helps us identify. I think loons convey a sense of place. We know we're on a northern lake. We know we're in clean water where there's great fish. And we know it's summertime when the loons are visiting with us. And so we're on vacation and the loons are here too. And of course, Katharine Hepburn in On Golden Pond.
Right. And nobody forgets the first time they heard that call.
Of course not. And so when you hear that on a summer night, it helps to sort of reaffirm, you know, where you are in our sense of place in New Hampshire.
Well, and Harry Vogel, you've been doing this work for a long time. Here you are still working with the loons after decades. Why do you love them so much?
Boy, you know, what's not to love? One of the first things that we hear when people come into the Loon Center is, oh, I had no idea that they're so big. And a full-grown male loon in New England can get up to about 15 pounds, so pretty close to goose size. They have that striking black and white plumage, that blood-red eye, and they have those distinctive and far-ranging calls. And so one of my very favorite loon quotes comes from a British researcher who way back in the 1950s described the nighttime calling of loons as a chorus from all of the devils in hell. And, you know, whether you love that sound or it sends chills up and down your spine, you're not likely to forget it or the bird that made it.
Or a little bit of both, right? Right. You love it. But I remember the first time I heard a loon call, camping on Lake Umbagog, of course. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night and you go, what was that? So let's hear a little bit more since we're talking about the call. This is a whale used to contact mates. Let's hear. So there it is again. Yeah. And Harry, what are some of the different calls that loons use to talk to each other? It's much more interesting than just hearing a duck quack.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, loons really have a very complex and beautiful language. And so that whale call that you just heard, often when loons fall asleep on their territory, unless they're on the nest incubating eggs, they're going to be over a deep spot on the water. And over the course of the evening, as they both fall asleep, they kind of drift away from each other. And when one or the other wakes up, they will give that whale call, and that will wake up its mate, and they will move towards each other. And so from that behavior, we can infer that what they're saying is, here I am, where are you, come closer.
And by the way, they mate for life, right? So it's kind of important that they stick together. Is that correct? Or is that an urban legend? I don't know.
They actually don't quite mate for life. And since we've started to band loons so that we can recognize individual birds and follow them through their lifetimes, you know, the old saying was, well, loons mate for life. And now we have to kind of say, well, they're like people. Some do, some don't.
Well, and speaking of loon calls again, here's a real classic one that a lot of our listeners will recognize. This is a tremolo. Am I pronouncing it?
Tremolo.
Right.
Yep.
Tremolo, used by loons as an alarm to defend territory or warn of predators. Okay, it's short, but there it is, Dave.
Right. So when you hear that call, generally it means a little bit of distress. So people love to hear the loon or the whale or the calls at night, the hoot. But when you hear that tremolo, that means give me some space. So when I hear that sound, I'm like, whoa, somebody's – that loon is upset. Something is upsetting it, whether it's a rival loon or whether somebody's approaching too close.
How important, Dave, are loons to New Hampshire's image, sense of what we are, the image we present to tourists in hopes that they'll come here?
Sure. I think that it's just it goes along with the old man of the mountain or the picture of the moose on the conservation plate. It is indicative of the fact that we are a northern lake state. When you get south of New Hampshire and Vermont and Maine, this is a species that drops out. Its natural range had reached its southern limit, you know, across northern New Hampshire. And that's the other neat thing, is it conveys a sense of time. This is an ancient bird from an evolutionary standpoint. They're very old in that respect. They've been nesting on New Hampshire lakes for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And then you begin to think about this bird over time and how New Hampshire's changed and how our lakes have changed. And for it to persist is a credit to the quality of our environment, but it also sort of implies a stewardship responsibility we have to our lakes that have been this way for thousands of years, and this bird is still here, but the circumstances around it have changed as we recreate on the lakes.
Well, we should definitely talk about that, the stewardship and the threats and so forth. But I'm interested in your thoughts too, Harry Vogel, on what Dave said. It's an ancient bird. What does that mean, really?
So we have loon-like birds in the fossil record dating back to about 80 million years, and there are recognizably modern loons that appear in the fossil record about 20 to 22 million years ago. And so we consider loons a primitive bird because they have existed in their present state for a long time, but they're also advanced in some way because they're highly specialized to that diving and flying existence.
But not walking. Many
not
people
walking.
May not even know that a loon cannot walk on land. And I think that's a surprise to people because they're used to seeing ducks, but their legs are placed so far back in their skeletal structure that they are unable to move on land by walking the way most ducks do.
Wait, I didn't know that. And
so
I've done multitudinous shows on loons over the years.
But they sort of push with their back legs. Their legs are further back, adapted for swimming and for paddling. So they're great in the water. They're sort of underwater flyers in the way that a penguin is, and people are familiar with that. But on land, they're cumbersome. So if they put down in a wet parking lot by mistake, that's it. They can't get up into the air again. They're not walking.
I did not know that, Harry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One consequence of those legs being so far back in the body is that a loon, the nest of a loon is always right next to the water. And that's one of the first areas where loons can run afoul of people, because loons love to nest on islands. We humans also love to nest on islands or alter shorelines. And by doing that, we can displace these loons from their traditional nesting sites.
And also water levels changing. So a wet spring, the water level's high, the loons arrive and they build their nests, and then the water level drops naturally over the course of May and into June, and those nests may be stranded. Or conversely, if they're built during a time of low water and then we have a change in fluctuation in the lake level, those nests can become inundated. And literally they have to either re-nest or they're done for the year.
And it's harder for them to reach that nest, you're saying, Dave, because they've got those super short back of the body legs, and
exactly.
They can't, like a duck can just walk up or a goose can just
right.
walk up and
so
find the nest. A loon can't do that.
If their nest is stranded above the low water level, they can't reach their nest. And then obviously if it's flooded, they can't access that nest either. So there's another thing. It was the ability of humans to recognize what loons need in terms of a consistent water level during their nesting season.
Well, one more question about nesting, and then we've got some listeners who want to join us, Harry. As I understand, loons only have a couple chicks, right? Unlike, you know, ducks, you see, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 ducklings, make way for ducklings, the classic book. Loons have 2?
Loons will lay only 1 or 2 eggs. And the average reproductive success over the past 40 years in New Hampshire has been a half a chick per pair per year. And that's one of the things that has made it so difficult to recover this species.
So they only have maybe maximum two chicks, and whether those chicks survive, it doesn't sound like the survival rate is that great.
Once a chick hatches, it has about a 70% chance of making it to fledge from the lake. About half of loon nests that are put down actually fail for one reason or another, many because people are approaching too close to that nest and flush the loon off of the nest. And that leaves that nest exposed to an eagle or a crow or a gull flying over, or a raccoon or a mink that's just working the shoreline looking for an opportunity for a good loon egg.
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong, gentlemen. I feel like I heard something the other day that the good news of the resurgence of the bald eagle here in New Hampshire, and I see them all the time now on the Merrimack River, has actually been bad news for loons, or is that too simple because eagles like loon eggs?
Eagles will take a loon egg if they can get it. They'll take a chick, and eagles have actually also been known to take adult loons. Most of the time that happens in the Midwest, where those loons are only about half to two-thirds the size of our larger New Hampshire birds. But more and more we're getting reports of eagles coming down and hitting a loon while it's incubating on the nest and actually killing that bird. So we do know that loon nests that are in close proximity to eagle nests are slightly less successful than nests that are not close to an eagle nest. But eagles are still not nearly as much of a problem as the effect of human activities.
Right, which we'll definitely talk about in a minute. The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're taking your questions, comments, personal experiences with loons. 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. Harry Vogel's here, senior biologist and executive director of the Loon Preservation Committee based in Moultonboro. Also with us, Dave Anderson, Director of Education with the Forest Society and co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones, and Beth joins us from Springfield. Hi, Beth, you're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Hi, I have kind of a question. I wanted to share an interesting experience I had. I was kayaking on Grafton Pond, and it was early morning, and a loon popped up right near my boat, and so I stood very still, and after a minute, two other loons swam up and started just hanging around by the boat, and then two more, and then two more, until
wow.
I was surrounded by nine of them.
That's amazing, Beth.
Yeah, it was, and I had never seen so many loons in one place, and I sort of thought they stuck to their family group, and I didn't know, is that a normal thing?
Wow. I'm so glad you called. And, you know, I've seen maybe two loons at a time, you know, canoeing or whatever, but nine, Dave.
So the Forest Society actually owns 6 of the 7 miles on Grafton Pond, and it has some of the highest density of nesting loons. And there's been a problem in recent years with a number of unmated or juvenile loons who are either fledged from that lake or nearby lakes. And this is sort of the struggle for real estate. And that's good that you were just still and the loons were comfortable with you. One of the issues is we have rangers on our boat launch at Grafton Pond, and part of their message to the public coming in is to give the loons space to stay, you know, at least 300 feet or 100 yards away from the loons. And people tell me, well, I'm in my kayak or canoe and the loons came to see me. Everybody wants that iconic photo of a real close-up of a loon riding on mom's back. And we ask people to, if they don't have a long, long lens, to not to try to come in too close and elicit that tremolo or that distress call. The loons that you saw may have been unmated juveniles, and they're essentially looking for an opportunity to establish a new pair. For many years, there were two nests on Grafton Pond. People thought that was really extraordinary for a pond of that size. And then a third nesting pair was able to divvy up the pond, and it's just prime fishing real estate. And it's so good for fishing that you've got these other unmated loons in the area. And that kind of constitutes a disturbance and actually has affected the success of the resident pairs that are nesting, because the male is so busy chasing off interlopers who are or juveniles or coming in and looking to kind of muscle their way into some territory on Grafton Pond.
Wow. So I'm just kind of astonished by this story. So many lakes, you know, people would love to have a loon or two. Does Grafton Pond have too many? Is that what you're saying?
Well,
Dave?
I don't think so. But some of the larger lakes that have been especially productive and are great fishing areas, Umbagog springs to mind, where there were well-established pairs over many years, are subject to other loons arriving in there and these large rafts of, say, unmated teenagers, the hoodlum gang of young loons, as it were, are distracting the male or female, just like if an eagle passed over. And that makes the adults less attentive during the incubation than it also sort of when they're brooding chicks and creates a threat to the young chicks on the water.
I see.
The adults are otherwise engaged in chasing off rivals.
Wow. So, Harry, can't the Loon Preservation Committee take those sort of naughty teenagers and move them somewhere else?
If only we could. Grafton Pond really is a great example of what's possible for loons in New Hampshire, because my experience as a loon biologist, the first time I went on to Grafton Pond, I thought, well, this is a great lake for a pair of loons, but you're probably not going to get a second pair. Then we got a second pair on, and they were productive. Then we got a third pair of loons on them, and they were also productive. And so we would like to see more lakes in New Hampshire with that density of loons. And you go up to northern – in Canada, for instance, there are lakes up there that are not pristine. You know, they have human activities. They have habitats and dwellings. They have three times as many loons on those lakes, more than three times as many loons as we have on our lakes here in New Hampshire.
Wow.
And that gives you a sense that even over these 40 years, we've been able to triple the loon population in New Hampshire, but we have a long way to go before we actually recover that species. And that's a lot of lakes that ought to have loons on them, that people ought to have the chance to enjoy those loons that are still empty. And we're looking to try and recolonize some of those lakes as we continue to recover that population.
Well, Beth, thank you so much for calling in. It's a great story. And wow, nine loons. I'm still taken aback by that. Here's another email from Melissa, also a kayaker. She says, as an avid kayaker, I've noticed a very big change in loon behavior over the last 10 years. During that period, both the loons and the kayakers have increased dramatically. Previously, Melissa says, loons were very skittish around kayaks and sightings were rare. Informed kayakers did their best to stay away from them. She says, today it is literally impossible to keep your distance from loons. Sightings are very frequent. Loons will surface close to a kayak and stay there or swim underwater. They make no attempt to move away from kayaks, even when they have babies in tow. They don't appear perturbed in the least by the presence of humans. Melissa says, I don't know whether this is good or bad, but I certainly enjoy the increase close-up with these beautiful birds. Do either of you know anything about this, whether loons on some lakes are changing their behavior and saying, oh, there's a kayak. Hello,
I don't know about that, but I've seen photos in this myself where a loon dives underneath your kayak or your canoe and sort of swims towards you and underneath your boat. And it's just a remarkable thing to look down on a loon swimming underwater. My theory on this, and it's not scientific, is that the shadow in shallow water of a canoe or kayak passing over flats will flush out a number of fish who are sort of hanging out there. It's kind of like this big shadowy thing. It could be a heron. It could be a predator. The fish move and the loons then move. You know, they can see when they're peering underwater. They have excellent underwater vision, and they see the little fish, bait fish as it were, scattering at the approach of a boat, and then they can swim right towards them. So we're essentially herding small fish that the loons respond to and go in and pick those up for food.
Wow. Harry, what do you think?
I think it's a great theory. I've never actually thought about that. One thing that I will say is if you are paddling kind of quietly along the shore and all of a sudden a loon pops up, especially if that loon begins calling, and sometimes if they are kind of diving and staying very close to you, it could be because you're coming up on a nesting loon. And so there are distraction displays that a loon will take to distract the attention of what it thinks is a potential predator away from its mate or its chicks or its eggs. And it's important, as Dave was saying, to pay attention to those signs. And if you see a loon that's calling or obviously in distress, thrashing around in the water, it's best for you to leave that area if you can and give them a little space.
Are you a little concerned? I think one of you mentioned this earlier, and here I'll ask you, that some people love hearing that loon call so much that they get close on purpose so that they can kind of stress out the bird and hear it make those cool sounds?
Yes. One of the unfortunate things is that the peak of nest hatching is right around the July 4th weekend.
Oh, and my goodness.
That's when a lot of people are out there on the lakes. And, of course, when we're watching these birds, we want to watch an intimate moment in the life of these birds. But as Dave was saying, the best, if you want to get close to loons, get a good pair of binoculars. If you want a picture of loons, get a nice camera and a telephoto lens. Because the problem is, if we begin to crowd in to these loons, they can stop doing doing what they're doing, what they need to be doing, which is feeding their chicks and protecting those chicks, and begin to react to us and move away. And any time you've caused a wild animal to change its behavior, you've impacted that animal.
You've created some stress, and that's not a good thing. All right, well, coming up, we'll find out more about how loon populations are doing these days, and we'll take more of your calls at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Knoy. Today in The Exchange, loons. We're looking at the many challenges this iconic northern water bird faces and what's being done about it. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to call with your questions, comments, concerns, and as we've been hearing, personal experiences with loons. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Now, a little bit later, we're going to turn our attention to the plight of another creature, the little brown bat. But for the next 20 minutes, we're talking about loons at 1-800-892-6477. And Harry Vogel, Dave Anderson, let's go right back to our listeners. And Mike joins us from Portsmouth. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
This is a great topic. Something wild that's it kind of piqued my interest about this. I live on the seacoast. So my experience with loons is generally in the fall and winter and spring, because I see them all the time in the Piscataqua. And kind of what I'm wondering is, what kind of adaptations do they have that allows them to inhabit the salt water in the winter months?
You know, Mike, that is a great question. And I've often wondered about that too, Harry, because it gets cold in New Hampshire, but they don't migrate. They go to the coast.
They don't go south. From banding loons on freshwater lakes in New Hampshire so that we can identify individuals, and then when we recite those individuals on the ocean, we know that New Hampshire's loons are overwintering from the coast of Maine down to about Rhode Island. So they're more or less New England birds year-round.
And how do they manage that long flight? They're big, they're heavy, when they're not known as great flyers.
No. You know, loons have one of the highest wing loadings of any flying bird. So next to the swans, they have essentially every square inch of their wing surface has to hold up more body weight than just about any other bird that flies.
Oh, because they're big.
Because they're so large, yeah. And so our loons are actually pretty lucky because they only need to go about 60 miles and then they can set back down in the ocean. One of the reasons why loons in the Midwest are so much smaller than these birds is that they have to migrate a much further distance. So if you're a territorial bird, there's an advantage to being big and muscular because it helps you to fight a potential rival and gain a territory and maintain that territory. But the payback comes when you have to carry that weight and go to the ocean in the wintertime.
Well, something to think about is, of course, you have to get off of New Hampshire lakes because the ice covers them. And so their adaptation is to go just as far as they need to go where they can winter over and fish and then be poised to return early and claim the best nesting territory. So the farther you go, the longer it takes you to get back. So if you're able to spend the winter on Buzzards Bay or on the Piscataqua River or Great Bay on salt water, you're very well poised to get back to Umbagog next spring.
Go ahead, Harry.
Most of us think of loons as freshwater birds that happen to go to the ocean to overwinter. It's actually just as correct and maybe more correct to think of loons as ocean birds that come to freshwater only to breed. And it's an interesting one of the theories on how this all evolved is that as loons became more and more specialized to catch fish and those legs moved further and further back and they found it harder to get to their nests, they could no longer deal with ocean tides. So one way to deal with that issue is to go inland to fresh water where there are no tides. And that's how loons evolved to have this kind of split personality between an ocean and a freshwater bird.
Well, you're right. And in my introduction today, I introduced them as, you know, New Hampshire lakes. Maybe it's because, Harry, that's when we see them. We tend, humans, not to be as out and about observing nature as much when it's, you know, January and freezing cold.
Sure. Yes, and the black and white plumage that we associate with loons, we actually call that the alternate or the breeding plumage. In the wintertime, they have a drab gray plumage, and so many people are out there looking at loons that they don't recognize as being loons because they're this very quiet and gray bird. They're not that charismatic black and white bird that we see on our lakes in the spring.
Still with the red eyes, though.
Still with the red eyes.
Yeah. That's interesting. Okay, and we've got pictures up on our website of loons and links to more pictures. So I'm hoping that there's a picture of a winter loon there so that I can look at it because I really couldn't tell you what a winter loon looks like. Let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Rich in Lyme. Hi, Rich. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I live up in Lyme near Post Pond, and we have loons with two juveniles there. Last year, we also saw a bald eagle flying by, and so I'm looking out saying, oh, look, there's the bald eagle. And, you know, and then I saw the bald eagle dive, and I said, oh, it's going to go try to get something. And then I looked down to the surface of the pond, and it's, oh, my God, he's going for the loons.
Wow, so you saw that. Oh, how terrible.
Right. Well, I went from cheering for the bald eagle to now I don't know who to cheer for.
Right.
I think everything turned out okay. The loons all ducked under the water, and the eagle hung around for a while, but we still had loons after that.
Well, Rich, thank you for the story. Dave, you want to jump in?
Yeah, that's a classic, you know, the joke about, you know, what does a biologist do if one threatened species is harassing another endangered species? And, you know, it quickly puts us on that slippery slope of being speciesist. Which species is more important, which is more rare, which is more threatened. But let's back away from that and recognize that bald eagles live here, loons live here. How fortunate are we to have the opportunities to see these majestic animals and understand that they're doing what evolution has prepared them to do. And also, we're on vacation. We're thinking about loons. We're away from our desks. We're having a wonderful summer out on the water, and we're watching, like David Attenborough, a naturalist, this wonderful thing go on. Meanwhile, eagles and loons are at the office. They're raising their chicks. They're nesting. They're surviving. And if something were to happen to a loon, understand that that's also something that is helping out the eagle family. So we have to sort of suspend our tendency to want to judge good and evil when we look at nature and understand that they're doing what nature has adapted them to do.
Well, Rich, thank you very much for calling in. And both of you touched on this a little bit, but let's talk about it some more. So, Dave, you know, sort of evoking when we see these loons, we're on vacation, we're out in the water, we're in our kayaks or whatever. But you're right, the loons are working. They're defending territory. They're protecting chicks and so forth. What should people do if they want to sort of practice good loon hygiene, if I could put it that way? And Harry, I know you have a lot to say on that too, but go ahead.
Well,
Dave.
I think one of the most basic things that we try to message with people is to give them some space. Don't crowd them. If they come to you, that's a different thing. But don't certainly chase them around in your canoe or kayak or your jet ski or your motorboat. Recognize.
Especially your jet ski or motorboat, right? Because the noise is stressful.
Yeah, absolutely. But just any kind of interaction where you're pushing them around or you're distracting them from what they're doing, which is fishing. And oftentimes, actually, they're actually catching crayfish. More often than not, I see them with a crayfish than just a bait fish. But give them some space. Enjoy watching them. And that's one of the most important things that you can do. Give them 300 feet. Give them 100 yards.
And Harry, in terms of shoreland development, New Hampshire's been debating, as you well know, for years and years and years, what rules and regulations are appropriate for the owners of shoreland property. What have you seen over the past, I don't know, 20 years, Harry, in terms of how people build on the water and what that means for loons?
Yeah, shoreline development is certainly a challenge for loons, but it's something that we have been able to mitigate through the use of nesting rafts, for instance. So one of the things that we will do is float these nesting rafts. They're about 5 feet by 5 feet, built of wood. They float, so they go up and down as water levels go up and down on some of these lakes, and they give loons an alternate spot to nest. And last year we floated 85 of these nesting rafts throughout the state, and one out of every four chicks in New Hampshire came from a raft floated by Loon Preservation Committee.
So you can say, okay, there's all these, you know, houses built right up to the water and boats and so forth, disturbing loons and their ability to reproduce. But then here's the alternative. Here's where man steps in and says, okay, sorry, we mucked up your habitat, but
yeah,
let's try again.
It's an alternative. You know, all of us would rather see a loon nesting on a beautiful piece of natural shoreline. The issue with rafts is they're a little bit of a Band-Aid solution. Over time, we're hoping that we can educate people and instill or encourage an environmental ethic that's going to result in these natural shorelines remaining natural. You know, don't put that last house on the island or the shoreline that removes that option for loons to be nesting there.
Well, everybody wants that house on the lake, though, Harry. That's so lovely to have that dock right in the water and be right there.
Absolutely. But everybody also, I think, wants loons. And sometimes, you know, it's so painful to go to a lake where every last spot, you know, we had to put a house on every last spot, including, you know, a couple of islands on the lake. And you just go out there and you think that's where a loon nest is going to be if there is. But there's a house there and there are people and dogs and things that come. And so we've just denied the loon that spot. And if we had saved just one of those spots, everybody on that lake could be enjoying, you know, loons and loon chicks. And having that great experience.
Dave.
Well, just another example of great enlightened self-restraint in New Hampshire, and this was another show that you covered earlier, is we have passed a lead fishing tackle ban. So New Hampshire's legislature, working with the Fish and Game Commission and other people protecting loons, have banned the use of lead fishing jigs. So that removes a potential toxin from the environment that affects loon populations. And I think that's a really good example of us learning what we need to do to alter our behavior and our purchasing in order to give them the best opportunity that they have to survive.
Let's take another call. And this is Ray in Guilford. Hi, Ray, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
And in fact, you just brought up the subject that I was questioning. The lead sinkers, weights that are banned, the issue I have with it is I know the loons take them to assist in their digestive ability, but I was wondering whether there is a size limit of the pebbles or gravel that they pick up and hold in their crop in order to assist in that digestive action. And whether they actually pass that through their system or whether it stays in their crop indefinitely.
You know,
and,
yeah.
And but, if the pebbles go through, why won't the lead sinkers go through? And it seems to be a total ban on all lead-weighted sinkers, where I would think there's only certain sizes that the loons would consume.
Well, It's a great question, Ray. And boy, this has been a longstanding issue, Harry. Just back up a little bit for us, please, for folks that aren't, you know, following this quite so closely. What's the deal with lead sinkers, the ban, the loons, and so forth?
Yeah. So we found our first lead-poisoned loon in New Hampshire in the late 1970s. So this is a 40-year issue that we've been attempting to deal with through education and other means of one of the issues, sadly, the profit margin on lead sinkers and jigs is higher than the profit margin on tungsten or tin or bismuth. And therefore, especially if you have limited space on the shelves, lead is what's available. So as much as we are asking people to stop using lead because we knew about that issue and just how devastating it has been to New Hampshire's loon population, when they went to buy tackle, all that was available was lead. And so after all of this time in educating, and we are seeing no reduction in lead mortality of loons, we knew that it was having a population-level effect, not just killing a couple of individuals here and there, but really inhibiting the recovery of loons in New Hampshire.
Well, lead is poison. I mean, we know even for people.
Yeah, absolutely. And for loons and other water birds, it's so much worse. And so the caller was asking about the size limits. And there are actually a few different ways in which loons can swallow lead sinkers or jigs. And one, the caller was quite correct. You know, loons will swallow small pebbles, and they hold those in the gizzard, the muscular portion of their stomach, and they use that to help grind up the food that they have eaten. And so they don't really pass those stones through. Every once in a while, we think that instead of a little pebble, a loon can get one of those little split-shot sinkers and swallow that. But there are a couple of other ways, and we now know that these are by far the more common ways that loons will ingest lead sinkers and jigs. And one is that the typical prey item for a loon might be a 4 to 8-inch yellow perch. But loons can, on occasion, swallow much larger fish. And when you get into fish of that size, you're talking about a fish that could potentially break an angler's line. And when that fish breaks free of the angler's line, it's going to trail a length of line and a lead sinker or a lead-headed jig. If that fish is going to be a little bit slower than the fish next to it, it's going to be behaving a little bit erratically, and that's the fish a loon is going to zero in on as an easy meal. And when it gets the fish, it gets the hook and the line and the sinker or the jig as well. And then finally, if you're fishing, you know, you're looking to catch a fish, but you could catch a loon instead, because a loon's instinct is to strike at something if it goes by it in the water. So from 40 years of data, we knew that the types of sinkers and jigs that loons were most often swallowing fell into that range of an ounce or less. And loons can occasionally swallow even larger, you know, sometimes much larger sinkers and jigs. But the majority of the sizes that we were finding were an ounce or less. And so that's what we approached the legislature, and we're successful finally in getting a restriction on the sale and the use of lead sinkers and lead-headed jigs of 1 ounce or less in size, because we knew that those were the ones that were killing our loons.
You know what I'm confused about with this, Harry, is we've been talking about this for a long time. Mm-hmm. I remember doing shows on this, you know, years and years and years ago. Why are loons still being threatened by lead? I mean, we've been talking about this for 15 years.
Yes, it's a great question, Laura. And I think in the past, it was because lead was the only thing that was available. So despite our educational efforts, when they went to, you know, if they lost a sinker or a jig and they went to buy a new one, lead was pretty much all that was on the shelves. Thankfully, that has now changed. Now the issue is grandpa's old tackle box, you know, in the dusty corner of the garage.
I see. You just grab it when you don't have anything left.
You just grab it and you think, well, I'm going fishing for a day. Is it lead? Is it not? I'm not sure. I'm just going to put it on the line and put this line in the water. But trust me, if it's more than 10 years old, it's full of lead tackle. So we're not asking people to stop fishing, but we are saying, you know, do yourself a favor and treat the loons and other water birds and buy yourself some non-toxic, non-lead, loon-safe tackle.
Well, and Ray, thank you for calling. It's a great question. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.com. And speaking of the lead fishing tackle, here's an email from Arthur. He says he fishes from his kayak and he has seen loons pursue fishing lures, in particular those shaped like fish. Arthur says this has happened on Shikorowa and Massabesic. You may want to make the audience aware of this possible hazard. So there you have it. Thank you, Arthur. Here's another email from Marilyn in Plymouth. She says, I camp at a remote site in a common loon nesting cove on Lake Umbagog, and she says, I wonder if the death of a loon by malaria poses any risk to humans on that lake. I'm so glad you sent in this question, Mary Lynn, because this was pretty shocking, Dave. I think it was last year people learned that a loon died of malaria. We think of malaria in, you know, Africa, not on Lake Umbagog.
Right. And so a tropical disease like malaria, I think that got a lot of attention, and there's been stories about blue-green algae. Some people say climate change, something is giving an advantage to the little critters at the very southern edge of what the loon's natural range has been. And I'm no expert on loon malaria or risks to humans, but I think it got a lot of people's attention because something seems to be going on in our warming state and on our warming lakes that is giving an advantage to some mosquitoes that are carrying diseases that had not previously heretofore been found in New Hampshire.
How shocking was that, Harry, to you?
Very much so to us. And one of because here we have a tropical disease that affected a loon in New Hampshire and not a loon.
And way north New Hampshire.
Right. Not a loon on the Massachusetts border. This was north of the Notches. This is on a northern lake in New Hampshire. And that's an area that we were thinking and hoping would be kind of a refuge for loons as that climate warmed and as these loons were beginning to be affected by these other stressors. And because loons are a northern species that are very close to the southern edge of their range here in New Hampshire, and because they nest at the water's edge, as we look at a changing climate, as we look at higher temperatures and more severe and frequent rain events, that is going to be a real challenge for our loons going forward.
And another northern species, I mean, you think about moose. And so something seems to be fraying the tapestry at the very southern edge of these iconic species that we associate with our northern forests and our northern lakes.
Well, and in another couple of minutes, we're going to turn our attention to the struggles of another creature, bats here in the Granite State. But one last question for you, Harry, before we let you go. Your group says that while loons are not currently on all New Hampshire lakes, you are working so that more lakes can host loons in the future. How do you get that started?
Yeah.
Put out a welcome sign, you know.
It's been a long process. And one of the things that we have found is that once an area loses its loons, it's really hard to get them back. And so even though we've tripled our loon population in the past 40 years, that's really painfully slow growth when you think about it. It's a 3% increase per year. And the past 5 years, that's slowed to 1% despite us setting new records every year for the number of rafts that we're putting out, the number of loon pairs that we're protecting with signs and rope lines, the number of educational presentations that we're giving. And last year, our population actually declined. And so these loons are facing growing challenges But I think that Loon Preservation Committee was founded on the hope and the philosophy that loons and people can live together. And so if we keep working on this, we're gonna keep having loons persist in New Hampshire.
Well, and I'll close this segment, Harry. Here's an email from Linda who says, the work of Harry Vogel has been critical to the recovery of loons in New Hampshire. Many thanks for what they do. So we'll close out on that. Harry, thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much, Lori. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about loons.
This is The Exchange on NHBR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We've been talking about the health of New Hampshire's loon population this hour. We're going to turn now, though, to another creature that's gotten a lot of attention and a lot of concern, New Hampshire's bat population. As always, let's hear from you, your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We want your observations, thoughts, comments about bats that you've observed in New Hampshire, and perhaps why their populations are going down. Email us, exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dave Anderson is with us, Director of Education with the Forest Society, co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. With us now in studio is Emily Preston, wildlife biologist at New Hampshire Fish and Game, and a bat expert at the agency. And Emily, it's good to have you. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here.
Well, we just had a great 40 minutes talking about loons. And Dave, as we said, a species that just evokes huge love here in the Granite State. They're beautiful. People love their calls. They're just this iconic species that people want to care for. What about bats, Dave?
Well, you know, bats have had a few challenges over the years. I mean, we associate them with things like Halloween, and you hear stories. I mean, just 15 years ago, 10 years ago, people were talking about the bat in the house, and they went after it with a tennis racket. But what I've noticed is as people have learned about the plight of bats and they're not seeing them anymore, there's a real respect and concern for bats. So their PR has improved, but unfortunately, it's at the very last moment, at the 11th hour, people are now very concerned and caring about bats because they're disappearing.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we heard from so many callers in our first two segments. People said, oh, it's so great. I saw a loon. But, you know, a few people come into work on a Monday morning and say, oh, it's so great. I had a bat flying around in my house.
I've actually heard people this spring come to me when the bats were on migration. The tree bats were arriving and they say, hey, I saw a bat. Like it's a unique thing, whereas they were used to be as numerous over the pastures as stars on a summer night. And it's really unfortunate to see the complete lack of bats.
What do you think, Emily? What's the PR for bats?
Well, it actually has improved. I mean, I certainly get a lot of people who are concerned about them. People are understanding their value in the ecosystem much more than they used to because they're paying attention. When people hear a plight of an animal, they're like, they'll sit up and take notice. And it's unfortunate that we have other species that are also unloved that could use a little love. But bats certainly getting better PR. People are more understanding when people call me and say, I have bats in my attic and I really want to get rid of them. And I say, well, you know, this is not a good time of year because the bats have pups. If you try to do an exclusion right now, you know, you'll exclude the adults. The pups will be stuck there. And that is, of course, really bad for the pups because they'll starve to death. But also the females will try to get back into the attic. And sometimes that means they're actually flying into your living spaces of your house, which is definitely what people do not want. So we recommend you wait until after August 15th to do that kind of work. And then a lot of people are like, well, I just want them out of my attic, but I still want them around. What can I do? And so we talk about putting up a bat house.
Well, and just to back up for a second, just remind us why bats are important to the ecosystem.
So bats are the biggest predator of night-flying insects.
So mosquitoes, which nobody likes.
Yeah, mosquitoes, moths, beetles. So there's a number of forest pests that fly at night, agricultural pests. So they eat a lot of bugs. An individual bat can eat half its body weight in bugs every night. And if it's a female with pups, she can eat even more. And most bat species only have one pup a summer.
So if you're worried about, you know, mosquito-borne diseases and, you know, insects just bothering you at night, show some love for the bats.
Absolutely.
Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. For the next 15 minutes or so, we're taking your questions, comments, observations about bats here in the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477. And Emily and Dave, let's go to the phones. And Sean is joining us from where? Hi, Sean. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. How are
morning.
You?
Morning. Good.
I've had bats around my house for 20 years in Ware, which was fine until they took up residence in the soffits of my A-frame dormers last summer.
Uh-huh.
So over the over the winter, I steal them up, and now they're gone. And I'm just wondering what I could do vis-a-vis a bat house. Where would I put it? When should I put it up to provide a place for them to eat my insects without living in my home?
You know, it's a question, I guess, Sean, I'm so glad you called, that probably thousands of people listening right now are having the same question. I want them. I just don't want them in the house. Go ahead, Emily.
So bat houses are great. They're a substitute for your house. What bats are looking for is a place where a lot of them can come together and get really hot. And there's big brown bats and little brown bats are the two species that really like that kind of environment. So what you want is a big bat house. You want it big and dark, so we usually recommend you stain them dark on the outside, and then put them up on the side of a building, 15 feet is ideal, but can be lower if necessary, where it gets a lot of sun. So we're talking the east, southeast side is the ideal, so it gets that morning sun and gets nice and warm, and the bats will just love that. And you want a big house. There are a lot of houses out there. If you're looking at houses and you see a house that's sort of the size of a birdhouse, I would not recommend that house. That's too small for a maternity colony. And that's what we're pushing for, is the females in their maternity
sure.
colonies. But you can find good plans and good houses on the web. One place to look is Bat Conservation International, their website, which is batcon.org. They have plans for bat houses, and they have how to put them up and how to attract bats. So they have a whole bunch of written stuff that can supplement that.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say make sure it's big enough, because in our old house, we bought it and there was a bat house. And we thought, oh, that's so cool. There's a bat house here. And the only bats we ever saw, like our caller Sean, were inside. So we thought, okay, bats, could you go to the bat house, please? But they didn't. So maybe it was too small.
It might have been too small. But also, they're going to pick the best place.
Oh.
So if you have a colony in your attic, they're not necessarily going to move into the bat house voluntarily, but they might. It's actually be seen that in some barn situations where the bats will actually then also use a bat house on the outside of a barn.
How do you make the bat house more attractive than your own house?
It's just,
you know, better lighting, better carpeting, better snacks. I don't know.
You know, we don't know specifically everything the bats are looking for. So I know people have put up bat houses. They put up big ones. They put them on the
sure.
southeast side of a building 15 feet up, and the bats never come. And it's just luck of the draw. And now with the bat population so decimated by this disease called white nose syndrome,
which talk about, yeah.
kills them in the winter, we're just, you know, not seeing as many, which is why I'm really encouraging folks like Sean to be very careful of their bats, and which it sounds like because he did a winter seal up. That's good to make sure that those bats have that opportunity to breed.
And you'll be happy to hear this, Emily. We had some bats in our attic. Gosh, must have been, I don't know, I can't remember how long ago it was, 3 or 4 years ago. And the guy who came to get rid of them was very careful about, no, I'm not going to do it for you right now. Here's what I'm going to do in the interim. He was extremely mindful of that breeding cycle. So even the pest control folks have really, you know, gotten their heads around when to do this and when to leave it alone.
Right. And when people ask me about that, I tell them to ask that question mm-hmm. of the wildlife control operator, because if they say, oh, we'll do it anytime, I always recommend that they pick somebody who cares a little more.
And so the role of education comes in again. So contractors are learning, homeowners are learning. And so the more we understand about what's going on bats, we're more likely to make good decisions. One thing I was interested to learn, that we may have 8 species of bats, but only some of them will winter communally in hibernacula. And there are a few species, and I always get this wrong, so maybe you can help me, the ones that actually migrate out of New England and then will winter singly in forest leaf litter or underneath bark of trees. And they are less affected by white nose syndrome because they're not all piled together in one communal hibernaculum. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. So white nose syndrome is a fungus that attacks the bats through their skin, mostly on their wings. With bats, wings aren't just for flying. They're also, there's air exchange through the wings, there's temperature control, and there is water retention. By trying to keep their wings closer to the bodies, they can prevent from being dehydrated. Now, the fungus interferes with all that because it breaks down the tissues. It's actually going into the wings and damaging the tissues pretty badly. But that fungus only grows in cold, wet conditions. So a hibernacula, ideal hibernacula, has about 80% humidity, and it's around 45, 50 degrees. Perfect for the bats, perfect for the fungus. And bats, when they're hibernating, their immune response is also turned off. Their
sure.
digestive system, everything's turned
just
off.
Just like any animal hibernating.
Right, right. So the animals that don't do that, those 3 migratory bats, they're called eastern red bats, hoary bats, and silver-haired bats, they fly south, and they are hanging out in the woods there, and they will go into a sort of a mini hibernation we call torpor when it's really cold down there, but they aren't in this communal damp places. And in fact, we have one of our bats here, the big brown bat, that is doing better with white nose syndrome for two reasons. One, they're bigger bodied bats, so they may not be as badly affected because they have more fat reserves to survive white nose syndrome. The other thing is a lot of them actually hibernate in buildings. So the one thing I definitely caution people is to try to do an exclusion before you do a seal up. So make sure that you're doing exclusion. And what that is you seal up some of the holes in the house and you put one-way doors on the rest of the holes that the bats are coming in and out of so they can get out. They can't get back in. And if you do that in the fall, then you know the big brown bats are out of there as well.
So the bats that are not hibernating in New Hampshire over the winter but are going south are not affected by this white nose.
We haven't seen any of them sick with them. There were a couple of silverhead bats that had the fungus on them, but they were found hanging out in a fort in Delaware, and they really they probably weren't staying there. It was during the migratory period, and they may have just picked up some fungus on their fur, but that doesn't mean they're going to get the disease.
Okay, that's interesting because I have seen bats flying around my backyard at night, and I was wondering what kind they might be. Let's go to our listeners again. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Cheryl's joining us from Nottingham. Hi, Cheryl. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi there. Good morning. I love the show, and thanks for taking my call.
Good.
So I have a couple of bats housed up, and they are occupied. We sometimes have as many as five bats flying around in the evening. And about a week ago, I noticed at least a couple of the bats could audibly hear them catch bugs. And they'd immediately fly back to the bat house and then fly right out. So I was wondering if they might have pups.
Well, thanks for the question. And can you figure that out, Emily? I mean, do they do what birds do, which is catch something and bring it back? Or do they eat it right
there?
They
don't. So it may be that they're eating quickly and trying to get back to give milk to their pup. But they're not doing that kind of feeding like we think of with baby birds.
Here's an email from Lorna who says, we really miss our bats. We used to sit on the porch at night and watch them. Lorna, thank you for that email. You know, Dave, we sort of touched on this earlier, but I'd love to hear from you on this. What's the broader ecosystem impact here in New Hampshire if there are so many fewer bats?
Actually, Emily already mentioned this, but the impact on forest pests, beetles, night flying insects that could potentially build up to levels that they haven't previously been able to do because they're kept in check by bats. Similarly with agricultural pests. Anybody who looks at a species and says, well, we don't know what good it is, and so we don't really care, we won't mourn the loss of them, is really ecologically not thinking about the bigger picture, which is all of these insects, all of these plants, trees, and bats have all co-evolved in our landscape over thousands of years since the retreat of the last glacier. So the missing, that Lorna's comment, missing bats is profound. I mean, you have that sense that there's something amiss, something has gone awry. There's a lot of things that we do not understand and not know. And so, again, Aldo Leopold said the first rule in intelligent tinkering is to keep all of the parts. So missing bats makes us think about what else we may not be aware of. One thing I'm fascinated by was hearing that white nose fungus is present in hibernacula in Europe, but doesn't seem to be affecting the bats there. So the question becomes, why are New England bats and North American bats seeing this unprecedented fast spread of a disease that's been present or a fungus that's been present in Europe maybe for thousands of years?
And hibernacula means?
A cave or a building where they spend the winter.
The place where they hibernate, right? Can you highlight that? That's really interesting, Dave, and I had not heard that. What do you know about that, Emily, that European bats seem to withstand this?
Right, European and Asian bats, actually. So it's a fungus that exists there. The bats will have it growing on them, but it does not have this devastating effect that it does here.
That's really interesting.
It is. It's, you know, our bats are not accustomed to this fungus. And eventually, maybe because we do have evidence that bats are surviving multiple years of white nose syndrome, those bats, if they can pass on whatever it is that's helping them survive to their young, then our bats will eventually adapt to this. Whether we will ever return to the large numbers of bats that we've had in the past, I don't know, because it would take decades and decades because bats reproduce so slowly. But there's research going on in Europe to try to figure out some of the things that the bats are doing to help survive white nose over there, and they apparently have had it for a very long time. And that's apparently where the disease came. So we have lots of other examples of diseases coming here, you know, smallpox in the Native Americans.
Sure.
Colonial people brought it over and it wiped them out. Didn't really, you know, they were much more susceptible because they weren't used to it. They didn't have the immune system set up to deal with that disease.
And so the term that biologists or population ecologists talk about is an ecological bottleneck, where they pass through the narrow part of the bottle, and then those that have survivability or the genes that favor that ability to survive that will then pass through that and pass that on to their progeny, such that it may be that European bats are carrying some sort of genetic predisposition to survive the fungus that North American bats have not yet developed. But I just think it's fascinating because it again conjures the image of time on the landscape, not hundreds of years or our lifetime, but thousands and thousands of years. And whether we're talking about loons or we're talking about bats or we're talking about moose, all of these species are iconic and have co-adapted with the things that have been present for thousands of years. And so these changes indicate that species are responding to change either successfully or unsuccessfully on this landscape over long periods of time.
Well, and I love the example, though, Dave, and I'm so glad you brought it up because it does raise questions. Okay, what could we do? The bats are working it out somehow in Europe. They've got that they figured out they're not vulnerable to it. American bats are. So what sorts of scientific efforts could be made in that area?
And one of the things that's really that we've been finding is that we have a barn where an owner has allowed us to monitor for years, and we are finding bats that we banded several years ago. They're still coming back. They're still having pups. And it's so that's like the good news, like, oh, some are surviving. They're actually reproducing. So that's very exciting. We had actually 10 banded bats found, previously banded bats found just this year in that same colony.
Well, one last question for both of you. And again, in our earlier segment, when we talked with Harry Vogel of the Loon Preservation Committee, you know, a 40-year organization with lots of support, lots of volunteers, lots of people emailing in saying, thank you, Loon Preservation Committee. Emily, where's the Bat Preservation Committee?
Well, New Hampshire Fish and Game, in partnership with New Hampshire Audubon, is doing a lot of bat work, and obviously in partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So there's a lot going on. We have some researchers in New Hampshire that are helping out, and everybody's just kind of doing little bits. And this is part of a huge international effort to work on white nose syndrome.
Well, real interesting. Emily, thank you so much for coming in. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Preston, wildlife biologist, New Hampshire Fish and Game. Dave Anderson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
Dave Anderson, Director of Education with the Forest Society and co-host of NHPR's Something Wild. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.